we've learned anything from these past couple of years, my fellow Americans, it's that personal medical freedom and liberty are in crisis. America Out Loud Pulse brings together the top experts in healthcare-related fields to keep you a beat ahead.
Hello, I'm Dr. Marilyn Singleton, and welcome to America Out Loud Pulse on the America Out Loud Network. Works on the scientific and ethical practice of medicine called the Corpus Hippocraticum are attributed to Hippocrates, who lived between 450 and 375 BC. And he's considered the father of medicine. But the quote, "Do no harm," is not in the Oath of Hippocrates. It's in another volume called Of the Epidemics. Additionally, the writings were written in Greek, and the Latin phrase primum non nocere comes from a 17th century English physician, Thomas Sydenham. Irrespective of the author's history, for centuries, the medical profession adopted the oath as a guide of professional conduct. Patients likely don't know any of the rules or the admonitions in the oath, but patients trust doctors with their health. The oath instructs physicians, among other things, to do everything for the benefit of the sick, to keep private whatever physicians see or hear in the lives of their patients, or some translations say, treat those patients' words as holy secrets. These duties attach whether patients were, as the oath says, free or slaves. Multiple surveys have asked patients what they really want from their physician-patient relationship. Just as with any close relationship, undistracted listening tops the list. Another constant is that patients prefer the total experience with the doctor and his or her office over price. If one wish could be granted for patients, it would be for more time with their doctor. My guest today is one of those physicians who's working to keep skill, compassion, and honesty in medicine, despite the roadblocks put up by current political winds and corporate takeovers. Travis Morrell is a husband, father, and physician leader. He's a lifelong learner, as he says, to a fault, and his medical training in five specialty departments gives him a broad perspective. He is a board-certified dermatologist and dermatopathologist in private practice in Western Colorado. Dr. Morrell is also chair of Colorado Principal Physicians, a truly grassroots organization defending nonpartisan physician values such as free speech and evidence-based medicine. Welcome to the show, Dr. Morrell.
Dr. Singleton, thank you for having me on. It's such an honor.
Well, I just have to get started. I always love to ask my doctor guests, what made you want to become a doctor?
Thanks for asking. I was always interested in medical science. I first went to nursing school when I was still in my mom's belly, when she was pregnant with me through her two-year nursing degree. But to be honest, I didn't have any doctors in my immediate family. And my, dad got through didn't even get through high school. But when I ended up in college, I ended up being pretty good at science, actually. And man, studying things like genetics, it was like just seeing the very fingerprint of God. I mean, biology, physics, it was all so fascinating to me. And then the idea that I could actually help people, but do it with learning through science and then, hands-on kind of helping people, to me, that just seemed like just too good of a job to be true. And I think I kind of sealed the deal. I remember my college was well enough off that they actually had two cadavers, and I was able to hold a human heart in my hand. And I just thought, oh my goodness, to be able to be a medical doctor, that would be just the greatest honor, greatest challenge. And I'm so thankful that I've been able to take this path.
We are too. And I'm sure any patients and Boy, any of those dermatology slides you look at, those patients are very thankful. My goodness, one of the scariest things on earth is getting that mole removed and wondering, is it melanoma, is it cancer, or is it normal? So you certainly do a big service. We're just going to start right off with being a good doctor. And so much is going on in medicine now. More and more doctors are leaving private practice, fortunately. So we hear lately people are jumping out of being employed and back into private practice. But at last count, 50% of doctors were employed by these big corporate entities. And these corporations are telling doctors what to do. And then we have the government telling doctors what to do. One of the biggest things that brought all this to light was, I always hate to say this, and I tell the listeners, I swear that I'll never say the C word, COVID. And I like to use it as little as possible. But the COVID fiasco pointed out government telling what doctors to do, corporations, hospitals telling doctors what to do. As a good physician, you think back to what you learned in medical school. Were you told you just blindly obey everything somebody tells you to do?
Oh my goodness. So we had classes throughout all 4 years called evidence-based medicine. And some of the medical students and residents that I sometimes supervise say that's not really an official class anymore. But for us, the patient-physician interaction, just you and the patient, is so important. In fact, it's central to medicine. And the fact that a patient can come to a doctor who presumably is an expert and get that person's free opinion, and by free, I mean not controlled by anybody, that of what's best for that patient. I mean, that is a crazy ability that we have in this culture. I definitely want to preserve that, the professionalism of medicine. And so, no, the idea of agreeing with people just to agree with people, like, it just, I've never heard of such a thing in medicine until really the past few years.
It's interesting to me because also what's come up in the past few years is this artificial intelligence. And we read these articles where they say AI is as good as a doctor. And I sit here and think about, if I were a patient, it's bad enough having the doctor typing on the computer while you're talking to them. Worse, if a computer is talking to you, I'm still trying to wrap my head around why AI, and maybe you know this, maybe you're recent enough in medical school that you were taught about AI. How is that better than being a real person?
Yeah, good question. I don't pretend to be an AI expert. I'm about 14 years out of medical school, and I, you know, it didn't take too many years into my second residency that I realized I was not as funny and not as in touch with the younger doctors. So I don't pretend to be an expert, but I think you're hit on something that you're right. The patients really like that compassion and the intelligent and caring touch of a doctor. I was always taught that that interaction between the doctor and the patient is part of what is supposed to heal. And so I, you know, if AI assisted technology ends up helping us make more accurate diagnoses, that's great. But we can never just put the patient in as just like a dry datum point. Like it's always going to come down to the doctor patient interaction and the trust that forms between us.
Somehow I can't imagine forming a trusting bond with a computer, but hey, people are really getting into that, and maybe I'm the one behind the times, but I don't know how a computer holds your hand or sheds a tear with a patient. So call me old-fashioned, but I'll take a real person any day.
Yeah, I'm not going to call you old-fashioned. I think most physicians would probably agree that EMRs have not really been a step forward. You know, they've required them, but they haven't required them to work or to help or to be efficient. And yet, like you're saying, they just take away time to see patients and time face-to-face. And I'm sure there's some benefits, but I remember paper charts. Maybe I'm too old too, Dr. Singleton. But those days, you know, you just look in the patient's eye the whole time, and it was, and you just write down what was important. But I guess I'm revealing my own age as well.
Tell the listeners a bit about EMRs. That stands for electronic medical records, or you might see it written as EHR, electronic health records. I remember when typing came in and people were very happy you could actually read the writing. But then it seemed like it got out of hand. Again, the government got involved way back when with the, what was it, the Hi-Tech Act, where doctors had to use these things if getting paid through the government. Explain kind of what's in them, because I think a lot of patients don't realize the pages and pages of questions that are there and they stay there in perpetuity. Explain a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, the fact of the matter is that doctors want to take patients and take care of patients and practice their art and science. But the truth is that generally, most of us that are still in the system get paid to chart, and you have to submit the chart. And not only that, you nowadays basically have to chart it in an electronic medical record on the computer. And the problem is, these aren't generally designed by physicians or patients. I mean, I guess everybody's a patient at some point, but they're not really designed with that interaction in mind. And then you're right that the government tends to require us to have a lot of information in there. There's things like called MIPS that the government requires you to put in to make sure you're doing quality things, but I have yet to see one that is clinically relevant. And so by the end of the visit, usually you have some like 9-page document for a, 5-minute visit where you're really just talking about one issue. And so I'll get, referrals from people really with 13 pages or 9 pages. And it's just a family physician saying, hey, this guy needs his, mole looked at or his cancer treated or something like that. So I think it's just a basically massive use of resources, and again I see that any doctor that has done both paper and electronic will tell you that their efficiency has kind of dropped anywhere from, I'd say most people say anywhere from 25 to 100%, which means you're either spending less time in the room with patients, or you're trying to squeeze in more patients, or you're trying to do two things at one time. I have a scribe so that I'm able to give my full attention to the patient during my visit. But I understand that not everybody can do that because not everybody's employer or their situation will permit that.
It's interesting to me because now they're starting to have these articles about cut and paste disasters, where because there's so many pages asking the same questions over and over that people are just cutting and pasting from the old chart. But things have changed, and things like allergies are wrong, and they keep on getting put in the chart over and over. Now, I say all this not to scare patients, and I'm sure you've had little things that have popped up in these records, but it's to tell everybody listening, you always have to speak up and you always have to say, now remember, I'm allergic to penicillin, or remember, I'm not allergic to bee stings like I saw in my chart. I mean, you've got to. The patient really has to be involved these days, and everybody's had glitches with the computer, and these electronic medical records are no different than anything else entered in the computer.
Yeah, it's good advice. Unfortunately or fortunately, just how it is, patients have to try and take responsibility and kind of look ahead for themselves. I wish it weren't the case, but that is a problem.
Yeah, well, I'll be very happy when I'm sure it's not going to happen when the electronic records go away and we go back to paper charts, but I don't think that's going to happen. I remember when Medicare went to electronic payments, it was because the IRS needed to track doctor payments. So there's too much plugged into the government's electronic systems for us to ever go back.
So. Yeah, I mean, I grew up using computers and very comfortable with them, but even so, it's I definitely would trade today to paper charts if I had an option.
One thing that I found, now I have interviewed patients for years, and during the years when lots of kind of regular people were doing drugs, and they certainly don't want to say that when you're having a visit, and they certainly don't want to say that if a computer screen is right there and someone's typing away. And one of the things I could do to get people to tell the truth, because it was so important for me to know, since I was going to be loading them up under anesthesia with tons of drugs that would have interactions, is I wouldn't be writing in the chart. It's like, this is for my information, and I'm going to write it down at some point, but right there when you're talking to the patient, you've got to be focused on them and let them know that their business isn't going to be strewn all over the street.
Yeah, I like that you're thinking of what the patient's feeling when we're dealing with the computer, and you're dead on. I think another thing people often don't realize is what a drain this is on bedside nurses. When I've shadowed nurses in the hospitals or worked with them, and I can ask, I'm sure my mom, I don't want to speak for her, but I know that they spend so much time charting just minutia. And I know it's just a drag, because most of them want to be, you know, having more patient interaction or as well. So it's a drag for the patients, the nurses, and the doctors.
Well, it certainly is. I had a friend who was a hospice nurse, and she just used to cringe every time she made her home visit because their program made them ask the same questions, even the address. And she's like, I'm here. I'm in their house. I know their address. I don't have to write it again. But it shows kind of the silliness sometimes of these computeroid questions, that they don't take human beings into account. We're going to have a break. And after the break, we're going to talk about taking care of human beings, patients as individuals. And this issue has really come up because there's been lately a lot of emphasis on categorizing patients into racial groups or LGBT groups or whatever. And for me, someone who's been a doctor a long time, it's kind of insulting because I took good care of all patients, irrespective of what group somebody wanted to put them in. So we're going to talk about that. And part of what being a principled physician is treating patients like individuals. And we're going to let Dr. Morrell talk about that after the break.
Cholesterol, blood pressure, blood sugar, inflammation, and weight. These are all real-world problems that 87% of Americans are struggling with. Fight back with HealRight. HealRight is a bar you eat, but it's food as medicine that addresses the nutritional root cause of health issues in just 8 weeks. Take action today. Visit HealRight.com/OutLoud or AmericaOutLoud.shop and use the code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
You've all heard Dr. McCullough and others share over and over the value of keeping your sinuses cleansed. It's a smart move all year, but even more so when we're cooped up inside. It's not really open for debate any longer. Those that live smart and live well pay attention to nasal and oral hygiene. Cofix RX has just the tools for the job with our nasal and throat cleanse. Click the Cofix RX banner on AmericaOutLoud.shop to get 20% off your entire order. That's right, AmericaOutLoud.shop. Use coupon code OUTLOUD. That's coupon code OUTLOUD for 20% off your entire order.
Use Cofix RX because it works.
ASEA believes that inside each of us is the potential to feel our very best. Our redox-based products tap into reserves within you to power your personal well-being. Make our breakthrough products an essential step in fulfilling your greatest potential. ASEA, we power potential. For exclusive savings, use code OUTLOUD to save 15% off your first order today.
Before the break, we were talking about taking care of patients as individuals and what a good doctor does. When a patient walks in your office, what do you see? Do you see that they're gay, that they're black, that they're Asian? Or do you see a person who came in and has a problem? Dr. Morrell's going to talk about how we should look at patients as individuals and not fall prey to what's going on in the political arena. Go for it, doctor.
Oh, thanks, Dr. Singleton. Yeah, so I think it's important for every physician that we were trained and we went into medicine because we believe that we want to have compassion for all of our patients. And I think that that human compassion, like you've already talked about, 100% stretches across whether you're black or white, gay or straight, or any other kind of other line that you might, you know, draw. And I think patients take pride in that. And I think patients trust that, and physicians take pride in that. And I think that, unfortunately, some of the diversity, equity, and inclusion kind of ideas that are going throughout medicine, the American Medical Association is intentionally trying to so-called embed equity, which means these diversity, equity, inclusion principles. They specifically refer to on their website critical race theory and intersectionality. These are a bunch of kind of nerd ideas that came from maybe the human resources world and the law world and sociology. And these principles do kind of put everybody in a box where people on one side of the box are fighting the people on the other side of the box, I guess. So basically, it's anybody who's white is some kind of oppressor, anybody who's black is somehow oppressed. And this is really sad because it really puts people against each other who aren't. And I think most patients, most doctors don't buy into this. And I think it's just unfortunately causing divisiveness more than it's due. I think something that's often missed, though, in this conversation is that if you really read the literature, which I've spent the past at least year doing, as I'm on a diversity, equity, inclusion committee somehow, and I've been able to listen to and read all the kind of stuff that we're required to read and more, some textbooks. And the truth is that it's not only against just saying all white people are oppressors, but actually basically anybody that disagrees with this idea is actually also enacting white supremacy. And so that's really unfortunate. And we've seen black physicians and other intellectuals who are black basically get, you know, either fired or degraded and so forth, just for basically being against the ideology. And I think that's important to point out that it's not really that DEI is racist, which it is. It's really about political power and having a politically powerful committee in every organization across the whole country. And they use these ideas to kind of that white and black people are against each other or oppressing one another to gain the excuse for the need for their power, which is really unfortunate. And one of the main ways that this is being kind of argued right now is that basically a black patient is more likely to die in the hands of a white doctor, and they'll have better outcomes if they see a black doctor. And they actually have a term for this. And, you know, if you, Dr. Singleton, if I said, you know, we're going to have a thing where kind of the black doctors tend to see black patients and the white doctors see white patients, you might come up with a word for that along the lines of, say, segregation. But the word that they're using is racial concordance. And I've seen this even cited in government documents where they'll say, you know, because this, they don't explain it like this, but they'll say, because this one study showed that sometimes black patients don't give white doctors as high scores on a 5-point Likert scale, which for our listeners, a Likert scale is just saying, you know, 1 to 5, it's like giving somebody 5 stars or 1 star. And in medical school, if I try to do research using Likert scale 1 to 5 data, I would be laughed at. That doesn't really count as research, but this stuff is getting published. And the reason is, if it's not clear to everybody, that's not really outcomes data. That's not showing that people were hurt or helped. That's about as science-based as, you know, your Google review. And so they published that this, because of that, one regulation that I saw in Colorado said basically not only are Black patients at risk with white doctors, but gay with straight, women with men, and so forth. So basically, all of us just can't understand each other well enough to, take care of that fracture or take care of that cancer or take care of that strep throat. And of course, that's just, I'm sorry, but it's just idiotic on its face. And more importantly, because in my group, Colorado Principled Physicians, we want to also be based on evidence. And Dr. Ian Kingsbury, who's he's not a physician, but he's a very intelligent researcher and evaluator of research. He did a major review the past month that showed that 4 out of 5 studies that do look at this, that's most studies, show that there's no outcomes. There's really no effect on outcomes. So I want to emphasize, you can definitely trust your doctor, regardless of their race or if they're gay or straight or if they're a man or a woman. You can definitely trust your doctor. In America, we have high standards for medical training. And, if you're a Black guy that shows up at the ER with chest pain, I guarantee that, white woman, white man, Black man, whoever it is treating you is going to do the very best that they can to treat you. And I think it's just a horrible message that a lot of even doctors in these big organizations are willing to push this, that they can't see what kind of trust we're going to erode with the public by saying that your doctor's not as good and not as likely to help you based on what you look like. That's just embarrassing, and it's astonishing. It's astonishing that people can't see the effect that that's going to have on the patient-doctor interaction. And it's astonishing that they would go around and see a world like that where most people that just don't look like them just wouldn't take care for them. I feel sad for people in that worldview, and fortunately, it's not reality.
You're telling me it's not reality. My goodness, when you see people interacting day in and day out, they're just treating people like people, and this creating division, it's sickening to me. It makes me sick. And you had mentioned what I would call segregation, they're giving new names to, so people won't see what's going on. And we know that all patients want is the best doctor in their field. This is what is amazing to me, that who would think that if you needed some sort of intricate surgery, you're going to look around and say, well, I guess I won't get it because there's not a doctor who's of my own race. Look at the intricate surgeries that neurosurgeon Ben Carson did. Do you think people would not go to him if they knew he was Black? Well, I guess when he showed up in the exam room, they figured it out, but they didn't cancel their surgery. It's just one of these things that all the political rhetoric and nonsense we hear does not comport with reality. I mean, in your career, have you seen this non-concordance, I guess you can say, or people treating people of divergent races? Have you seen people treat patients differently? You don't have to name names if you've seen it.
Man, I would have to really think about that. I don't want to say flat no, but I have to tell you, the very I can't think of an example off the top of my head. I the vast majority of people that I meet, I can't name a doctor that I don't believe is trying to help their patients the best they can. And that includes, people of both political side, any race, any gender. I'm just not aware of that being a thing in medicine. Maybe I have rose-colored glasses, but, left or right, I think physicians are trying their best. That being said, this, that being said, this, I will say I've had some patients just the past couple of years, and this has never happened to me before, call my office and say, what's the doctor's political opinions? Because we only want to see a doctor of a certain side. And of course, I am nonpartisan publicly, but it's just really sad. I've never seen that. So politically, I guess I have had patients complain about being mistreated for their kind of political beliefs or health beliefs, but I've never seen it, let's say widely based on race.
That's very interesting, asking about political beliefs. I just think these are things that wouldn't have even crossed anybody's mind. But let's face it, this is all part of the on purpose creating divisions among people to where they'd even be thinking about that. There's sort of a joke that President Reagan had told when he was shot. And I know people who were there, so, you know, it is true. He just asked, he says, "Well, are you guys Republicans or Democrats?"
That's right. That's right. I remember that.
So it's the sort of thing, but that was a certain situation. Certainly on a day-to-day basis, it's hard for me to fathom that when a patient is going to a doctor, that would be one of the criteria they're looking for. I would say my only discrimination that I ever had was for being a woman, but not for being Black, which is sort of interesting. And it didn't happen often. Over the years, a few occasions where the patient thought, "Oh, you're a woman." And it's kind of like, "Oh, really?" But even in urology clinic, when all the patients in there were male, they never said anything. And I thought, gee, this is fine. And I think the only patients I ever kind of had a pit in my stomach when I was treating were criminals that you knew had just shot and killed some poor little store owner, but you had to take care of them on the trauma service like everybody else. And they actually did something. It wasn't their skin color, but you know, what was going on in your stomach didn't translate to what you did with your hands and your mind.
I appreciate that, having family in prison, and I always enjoyed taking care of prisoners, and you gave them the highest care that you could too. And I want to add to, like you mentioned, being discriminated against at times for being a female. I definitely have seen patients occasionally, I don't think commonly, but occasionally treat doctors differently. It does happen. And I definitely know that there, unfortunately, before my time, man, we have done some pretty horrible things based on race and gender, sterilization, the Tuskegee experiments. So I definitely know that's happened, but thank God we've come a long way. As a different poll, you know, we've seen since 1958, I think, to more recently, the approval of interracial marriage has gone from like 4 to 6% up to 96%, and it's 98% in people under 30 today. So it's not that there's not some racism out there, but boy, we've come a long way, thank God. And so that's at least some good news.
Well, it is good news, and I hate seeing it denied that we have come a long way. And let's face it, there's always going to be racists. There have been. Read the Bible, read Greek mythology, Roman mythology. There's always going to be people who are prejudiced. And I'm not talking about certain personal biases. I think we all have biases. But economist Walter Williams always made the distinction that there is a big difference between prejudice, bias, and preference. And he used, since he's now deceased, the example of brownstones in New York. He said in the beginning, after people divided up brownstones when people needed housing, they didn't want to rent to Black families. Then they realized there weren't enough white families to rent it. So it was like, hey, they needed the money. So they rented to Black families. So that started off a preference, and then economics made that preference go away. And I think in medicine, the thought of having the best care from the best person, even if you had a preference, started off with a preference, getting the best should make that preference go away, unless you're some sort of hardened racist or misogynist.
Oh, 100%. My son broke his femur. He had a non-cancerous tumor and he was 8. And, you know, at the hospital, I just can't imagine looking at someone and caring, you know, if they had a third arm. You know, you just care if they're good and if they seem to care for your child. So that's ridiculous. And I want to affirm what you said about the divisiveness and politics. people really should pick up some of these books on the diversity, equity, inclusion side and actually read them and sit and think about what they mean. You know, when you read a popular book that my organization, sorry, not my organization, but one of the medical associations that I belong to recommends, A White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo. When you read through there, she really has a problem. She has a really kind of weird problem with Black people when you read through there. And she openly states that basically white people and Black people can't be friends because, you know, the understanding can't cross that racial barrier. And you're just like, oh my goodness, she actually thinks this. She says it multiple times. And it's also, again, it is political. It's not just about race, this divisiveness. It's the intent is to change politics. Just one quote off the top of my head from White Fragility is, white people raised in Western society are conditioned into a white supremacist worldview because it is the bedrock of our society and its institutions. And I can quote her again and again and again, but she really sees the problem as Western society, or, you know, American, United States, European society, which is the society that has fortunately moved us from these kind of deep racial barriers, which we definitely had in the past. It's the society that's helped us progress through that. And it's the society that encourages us to treat all people equally. And at the end of the day, what, you know, if we have biases, the point is that we're supposed to try and become better people and treat people equally. And that's I think the promise of the medical profession.
Well, you said that very well. And after the break, we're going to talk about you, really, some of the things that these CRT type folks, white fragility type folks, I find actually insulting to Black people. And one of the things is the idea that you have to lower standards for getting into medical school in order to find more diverse student body. So we'll discuss that after the break.
Many voices, one freedom, united in the First Amendment. Our goal is to herald the voice of genuine liberty at AmericaOutloud.news, a place where you'll find the naked truth expressed with a patriotic heart. Now is our time, my fellow Americans. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
Cardiovascular disease is the leading cause of death and disability. Today's high-stress, on-the-go lifestyle makes it hard to stay heart healthy. Lifestyle changes like exercise and diet are critical, but you can also support your heart with concentrated nutrients. Healthy Cell created Heart and Vascular Health to support three aspects of heart health: cholesterol, blood pressure, and triglycerides, with CoQ10, vitamin K2, resveratrol, and soluble fiber. And Healthy Cell's not a pill. It's a patent-pending gel you swallow with ultra-absorption of science-backed ingredients. You would need to take 13 pills to get the same amount of nutrients in each gel pack. And these great-tasting gels come in a small packet. Tear off the top, shoot it down, or mix it in water. Get heart healthy. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order. HealthyCell.com, code OUTLOUD for 25% off.
I'm so confused. I don't know what to do.
I'm afraid of going to the hospital.
My doctor tells me nutrition doesn't work.
Trust is earned. We are the Energetic Health Institute, and we want to earn your trust. Natural medicine, holistic nutrition, detoxification, fasting, cellular healing, and so much more. Remember, the best way to be free is to be healthy. So stop being a patient and start being a student at energetichealthinstitute.org.
Before the break, we were talking about some of this DEI and political rhetoric and what it has to do with medicine. One of the things that really bothered me is the idea of changing standards while trying to seek a, as it said, a more diverse medical workforce. And diversity is wonderful, and it used to be a good word. Now it's become a bad word, a curse word, the way it's been changed. And we're not supposed to have quotas, and diversity didn't mean quotas, but suddenly now it does. And manipulating medical standards to meet the quotas, to me, just seems wrong. What say you, Dr. Morrell?
Well, I think that people see the diversity, equity, inclusion as a way to increase the number of Black people becoming doctors. And of course, you know, that sounds, I would just like more doctors, and everyone should be able to access, you know, medical school if they meet the criteria. I think the problem is that somehow DEI is getting a pass as if it's really pro-Black. Because, you know, a lot of people do think, well, you know, America in the past has done some really horrible things to Black people. And there are some inequities if you look at it by race. And so they feel sorry. And sometimes we just focus on that empathy instead of focusing on how to actually help them, instead of just focus on the empathy and go wherever our feelings lead us. And I think one thing that kind of shows that DEI is not really actually trying to help Black people is when you read about the Gifted and Talented School that was closed in Seattle last week. I don't know if you saw that. And it was closed on the basis of inequity. And this was in the Seattle Times and other major newspapers. And a lot of Black parents were begging the school to like keep it open because they had their Black children that were doing well in this Gifted and Talented School, and it was going to help them. And the people that were from the school district dismissed those Black parents as, quote, tokenizing, which I feel like I would be offended by. You know, when people argue with DEI, even if they're Black, they're somehow dismissed. You saw Coleman Hughes got, I thought, sort of degrading treatment on The View last week for having a very intelligent position. And basically he was dismissed as a puppet. So we have to remember that here's a school that's trying to help Black kids and all kids. But if Black parents want that, they're just tokenizing. So I don't think that DEI is really going to fix this. And even though, yes, the AMA, the American Medical College, Associated American Medical Colleges, and all the major organizations are very much in favor of choosing medical students based on, number one, race. And then I'd also say, number two, their agreement with DEI. So starting with number two, there are articles out there. John Saylor, S-A-I-L-E-R, is one reporter who's shown that most medical schools require DEI pledges, basically, or some kind of statement to get in, and then again to get promotions. And then by race, yeah. So when the Supreme Court came out last year and said, hey, you know, Harvard, UNC, you guys are not only discriminating against white kids, you're also discriminating against Asian kids, and you can't do that anymore. You have to just use the scores. And I don't want to hit on this really hard, but, you know, an Asian kid had to score crazy, crazy, crazy high to get into these medical schools where other races did not. So there definitely is a difference in, at least at that level, in the ability that they're requiring. And when the Supreme Court came out and said, like, you can't do that anymore, immediately that day, the AAMC, which is the American Association of Medical Colleges, came out and condemned that, which it's just like, how can you condemn anti-discrimination? And basically every state or most state and specialty societies came out within the day to say the same thing. And that's really crazy if you think about it, because if you look at Pew polling, which is nonpartisan, 82% of all Americans are against using race as a discriminating factor in school admissions. And they're definitely doing that. And if you're picking by race, you're not picking by scores or leadership or anything else. So obviously, that doesn't seem like a good idea for any school. It doesn't seem fair for any school, but definitely the people that are doing your brain surgery or taking care of your kid, that's really not how you want them to be picked. But again, I see an even bigger issue is that this is all used really as a wedge for just unlimited political power and basically arbitrary political power. So
it's very interesting, and I'm sure my listeners have heard me go on about this. There's a book that I read several years ago, and it's sort of a Bible of revolution. It's called True Believer, The Making of a Mass Movement by Eric Hoffer. He was called the longshoreman philosopher. He had a daily column in the San Francisco Chronicle. One of the things he talks about in The True Believer is in order to change things, which I think many of us can agree that there's a certain group of people out there that want to change our system, our society, our economic system, etc. And Hoffer says in order to change things, you've got to make people miserable, that happy people don't jump into a revolution. And one of the things they tried to do is make us miserable, that and divide us. And, you know, who said it years ago? Caesar, divide and conquer. And this division just can't keep up. And it makes people sick to think about it. And fortunately, most people aren't thinking about it every day. They're just going on with their lives and doing what they do and earning a living and trying to support their family, save enough to go on a vacation. But people like you and me, we're sitting there thinking about this kind of stuff all the time. And a patient, we don't want the patient to be thinking about this kind of thing when they come in, and particularly in emergencies when they're in vulnerable situations. I'm just so proud of you that you started this organization, Colorado Principled Physicians, where you try to get the word out that all we want to be is good doctors and treat people as individuals. But how do you fight things when it's a political trend and there's this rhetoric out there? And like you mentioned, The View, these shows that people watch where these people who aren't that bright just spout off this stuff and repeat it. And they probably even haven't read the books, but they just repeat the mantras. What do you do about that?
Dr. Singleton, great insight and great question. Yes, most of the people that are kind of pushing the diversity, equity, inclusion, and some of these other divisive ideas haven't really read the book. They're fitting in. They know that if they say one thing, they'll get in trouble. And if they say the other thing, that they won't. And so, and they'll even beat up on other people, like the host was beating up on Coleman Hughes, which is shamefully. They'll beat up on other people so that they can, you know, get points and fit in. And, you know, the truth is that we all do kind of try to fit in. And even in medical school, you do become socialized into what it means to be a doctor, and how you act and the coat that you wear and stuff like that. But we're supposed to be trying to become better doctors, not get off on these kind of wild ideas. So I think that the reason we have to ask the question, how did we get here? If most people don't really think this stuff is crazy, most people think this stuff is crazy, right? Most white people, when they see a black doctor, they think, oh, this is going to be a great doctor. And most white doctors, when they see a black patient, they say, oh, in their head, they're wanting to do the best for them, right? That's the vast majority of people. Most people would be very happy to have an interracial friendship just as any other friendship. That's normal people. And I think for one thing, nobody speaks up. So I don't think that they have more numbers on their side. They definitely don't have a better or happier or sunnier worldview. They don't have the evidence. I think what we've gotten to a point, though, is that free speech is kind of limited. And even if it's legal to speak up, people realize that, oh, I have to do my mandated class on implicit bias, or I'm afraid that my medical license might be threatened, or my job might be threatened, which we've seen people definitely lose their job over this. We've even seen black intellectuals lose their job at this. I think a Dr. Tabia Lee, who was actually a DEI director at a college. So they're afraid, you know, I'd add our board certifications. My board certification says that something to the effect of that I have to support diversity, equity, inclusion. So the idea is if I don't, then I could be considered unprofessional. And unprofessionalism, as you know, is basically a reason to, you know, put on probation or take or something, your certification or your license. And doctors, if they don't have their license or certification, they can't work. So that's a pretty big threat. And it's really been that top-down threatening approach that our organizations, and I guess I'm naming names today, but these organizations have taken that's allowed this these crazy ideas that really nobody believes to grow and fester. And so that's why me and several colleagues, now dozens of colleagues, and growing very fast across my state in every specialty, that we decided, you know, the answer is we need to beat it back with free speech. So I'm speaking openly on this. We're also, there's a lot of other like practical kind of things that we're doing. But the first thing is that we need to have free speech and free discourse in our medical societies and associations and with the public. And, you know, if some of us maybe will get some kind of blowback or maybe not, that's fine. But clearly these things are off the rails. There's nothing that's going to stop them except for just the normal people, like you're saying, that just kind of got to pay the bills or want to go on vacation or whatever. All of us kind of normal, friendly people have to kind of speak up, or this is just going to keep getting worse and worse.
I'll say, and speaking up is so hard. And as you mentioned, people's jobs may be at stake. And I'm sure there's many a person who signed on the bottom line, do you believe in diversity, equity, inclusion? If they just asked that as a simple question, and of course you believed in inclusion, who wouldn't we want to be an inclusive society? But unfortunately, it's DEI is a code word for segregating people into silos for a political purpose, not for their benefit. I mean, who's it helped? It hasn't helped anybody. I haven't seen anybody raising their hand and say, oh yeah, the DEI policy at my job really helped me get ahead. No. And all true diversity, like it was in the old days, was just making sure you didn't discriminate against people because of their color or because of their gender. When I applied to medical school, this is an illegal question now, but I was asked, did I have a boyfriend? Was I engaged? Did I plan to get married? Because as you know, women tend to drop out once they get married, and you would be wasting a spot for a man. That is what I was told in an interview at USC. University of Southern California, USC, Trojans, names, not just initials. And you can't do that anymore. Now, 50% of medical school students are women. And indeed, women are just as good doctors as men. So it's kind of silly. And it's funny to me when I think of women doing surgery and everything, that early on, I did surgery residency for a couple of years, and when I was admitted to the residency, one of the chiefs says, well, you know, women are good at sewing.
Oh my goodness.
I digress, yeah. But there was an article in the Journal of American Women's Association talking about what happened when the first female cosmonaut came back from outer space, that she was given an apron as her gift. So,
oh my goodness. Well, so we're not going to say it was never bad. It definitely was bad, but we've come a long ways.
So that's, I think when you say we've come a long way, we really have. And I think a lot of people these days don't realize how bad things really were. And there's no way we'll never forget about the Tuskegee experiment. We'll never forget about forced sterilizations and what they used to call the Mississippi appendectomy, where they tie a woman's tubes and without her knowledge. All these things happened. We can't say they didn't happen, but they're not happening now. We have to ensure they won't happen again. But denigrating our colleagues isn't going to improve medical care for anybody.
Yeah, I can't say it better than what you said. We need to speak openly and comfortably about racism. We should speak openly and comfortably about the history, but we should also speak openly, comfortably, and with perspective about where we're at now. And, you know, will things continue to improve? I think things will. You know, you alluded to the fact that probably more than, I think it's now it's probably more than half of medical students, I think, are female, you know? And so obviously, even though some fields are heavy on men, that's clearly going to change without a single DEI policy. I'm sure they'll take credit for it if they're still doing it for 10 or 20 years, but you just give it enough time. Things have changed and they're going to keep changing going forward. And we're happy for that. And I wrote it down. Your DEI is for segregating into silos for political purposes and not even for their actual benefit. You're dead on.
Well, you are dead on with your organization, all the work you're doing to try to keep principled doctors in medicine, because that's what patients need. Can you tell our listeners your website?
Oh, thanks, Dr. Singleton. Yes, it's just coloradodoctors.org, coloradodoctors.org. And they can also follow me on Twitter at Morrell, two R's, two L's, MorrellMDMPH.
Okay, thank you so much for coming on the show, and I'm sure we will talk again.
It's a pleasure and an honor. You're very kind. Thank you so much.
And I'd like to thank everybody for listening to America Out Loud Pulse. As you know, we are always a beat ahead. Now, remember, if you have any questions, whether for the host or the guest, you can send them in right under the picture or the title for the show. There's the email form you can fill out. First names are fine, and we'll get back to you with an answer. And as I mentioned earlier, we've got our shopping site, AmericaOutloud.shop. Use the discount code OUTLOUD. You can buy books written by our guests and other books of interest, any of the products we talk about. Go to the shopping site, run through it. There, you may find things that you're interested in, and remember the discount code. So like I always say, whether you agree or have other opinions, please share the show. And until next week, say it loud. I'm free and I'm proud.